1-2, 1-2, 1-2.
Do it again, Carl.
1-2, 1-2, 1-2.
One more time.
1-2, 1-2, 1-2.
Yeah, that seems to be working. Okay. Let's put it as close to Michael as we can. I'm kind of the audiophile. I'm the guy that'll try to keep all the gain right. Okay. Most of the questions will come from Carl.
Okay.
And if you don't mind, it is warm in here.
Yeah. And it's actually 62 degrees.
That's and again, we're just interested in if you could reiterate later the story about Freeport MacMoran or MacMoran, that would be fine.
Which story?
Just the 30,000 well.
Oh, yeah.
But let's
we need to get the legal niceties out of the way first, Mike.
Yeah.
As we indicated to you earlier, this is part of an oral history program run and administered by Louisiana Sea Grant and LSU. The materials that it generates will be placed at LSU in Baton Rouge, the Sea Grant office here, and hopefully in Washington, D.C., and at the University of Lafayette. And it's going to be used for research purposes. It may be used in documentaries. It may be used in something like this. Where some of the oral materials, some of the visual materials made their way into this part, a calendar about the history of the coastal plain. I need to say up front that there will be no monetary compensation for any of this or anyone involved. But basically, as I said, its whole intent is to preserve the living memory of the area for future generations and to make it available for researchers for interpretation. So, first of all, is it okay for us to record this and to put it in these repositories?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, thanks. And at any time, if you're uncomfortable with the questions, if you need to take a break for whatever reason, please just let us know.
Yeah, and just give us your name and who you're associated with, please.
My name is Michael Vanover, and I am the president and CEO of the Brownell Land Company, located in Morgan City, Louisiana. Company which owns land in St. Martin, St. Mary, Terrebonne, Iberia, Assumption, and Iberville parishes.
Well, what we'd like for you to do, Mike, is to give us an overview, please. You were talking earlier about the environmental changes that have taken place and the economic changes that have taken place in this area. So can you just give us sort of a thumbnail sketch from the beginning?
From the beginning. Well, early 50s, Morgan City was a hot spot for oil and gas drilling. Prior to that, it was strictly a fishing and trapping, shrimping industry. Matter of fact, the Brownell family owned the People's Ice Plant on Front Street at the time. And when the drilling started, it kicked off a whole new industry in Morgan City. It became a very active town. The city, the people, they grew. All companies moved in, leased up properties, and they started drilling in shallow water in the Gulf of Mexico out of Morgan City. It was a safe haven from hurricanes, and they started drilling onshore and in the Chaffalai Basin using barge rigs. The drilling at that time was pretty much restricted to more or less hydropressure type wells. They didn't have steel. They could manufacture pipe that could handle geopressure material at the early wells, so they were generally not deeper than 12,000 feet. And over the 50s and 60s, they produced pretty much all of the production that was available for oil and gas above 12,000 feet. Then we started to get pipe developed in Japan. Sumitomo and Nippon Steel developed methods through which they could make a seamless casing that would have a greater tension burst and pressure rating than the normal electric well pipe like they did at Longstar Steel, for example.
Okay, and what's the time frame here?
Time frame is the late 60s, when we really got the material that could let us go deeper. So we started drilling deeper, and then as we drilled into the 12, 15, 16, 17, 18,000 foot ranges, we found new problems. We had tremendous pressure. The challenge of drilling through all the depleted zones that were already there made us use a multiple string casing, multiple designs to make a telescope almost backwards going down it get down to the oil. And we managed to get down to that 15,000 foot, 18,000 foot, and then we were producing wells at around 10 to 15,000 PSI fluid pressure. Greater volumes of oil. And that was really when everything kicked off. Money started flying everywhere. Money didn't mean anything at all.
So we're talking about early 70s.
Early 70s. We'd go to Japan, for example. I'd go to Japan as I was working in Houston at the time, and I'd negotiate agreements for tonnage. We wouldn't even specify what we wanted it in, whether it was casing or sheet metal or whatever. We just would just tonnage, because we couldn't get it here. Mm-hmm. The big United States steel, like, it was just a big inert giant. It couldn't keep up. It didn't improve its technology, and it could not do it. So we started buying pipe that could drill deeper. So then we started going down further, down to 19, 20,000 feet. And all of a sudden, we hit a new problem called sour gas, hydrogen sulfide, one that we never had to face before. And we had a lot of accidents. A lot of times we'd have cows dying in a field a mile away from the drilling site and didn't understand why they were dying.
This is noxious gas being released.
It's a poisonous gas, and right. What would happen, as we were drilling, it would come up and get into the aquifers, and the gas would flow with the aquifers and come up into the streams, and then it would go into the atmosphere and kill whatever breathed it. So we had a whole new problem. We had a situation where we had a sour gas that was deadly to deal with, and we had to find material that wouldn't rust. Sour gas acts on steel like electrolysis does. It destroys it. Mm-hmm. And so we went back to Japan, and we met with them, we talked to them, and convinced them that they should be making a softer material that could handle the tension, burst, and collapse of the other stronger type materials. And they did that. They shipped that to us in boxes. Each tube was wrapped up in a box, because you couldn't dent it or touch it. Because if you took a hammer and hit the pipe and then put it in a hole, a sour gas would attack that one spot, because you change the molecular structure of the steel when you hit it with a hammer. So that was a whole new area for us there. And that was kind of the beginning of a frontier of deep well drilling. And then over the years, we continued drilling into that 18 to 20,000 foot range, but deeper than that, it was very difficult because of the number of depleted zones, mm-hmm. and the liners that you had to run to get down to them.
Mike, if I can interrupt you just for a second. As with this, we want to make sure that the technology is working as advertised.
Yes, and we're good here.
Yeah,
you got it?
Yes, we're good here.
Anyway,
it says stereo, is that all right?
Yeah.
It should be okay.
So we're working our way out through the generations at the beginning of the drilling, light, hydropressure to geopressure. Now we're going to geopressure hydrogen sulfide environments, and now we're going down deeper, and we're working to what we talked about, like the McMurray program. Mm-hmm.
Now this is about 30,000.
These wells are going to 30,000 feet, and I don't know anything about the mechanics. The questions I had when McMurray and when we agreed to a lease was, I'd just like to see the mechanical design of the well so I can understand how you drilling that deep, how big a surface pipe are you starting with, and what kind of pipe you're going to have down at the bottom to produce through, because mm-hmm. it's got to be a tremendously large surface pipe to keep putting those liners all the way down. But they won't share that information yet. That's still confidential to them. Mm-hmm. They're drilling one well in the basin. I had a meeting with them a few weeks ago, and they're telling me they probably, if they hit what they think they're going to hit, they're going to try to form an 8,000 acre unit, if the state will let them. Nobody's ever done that. Usually a normal drilling unit right now is 320 to 360 acres, and they're talking 8,000 acres, and that's going to be a real big circle. And I would imagine if they do hit and form an 8,000 acre unit, they're going to do several more wells in mm-hmm. that unit to produce it quicker to get to it. But that's the stage we're in right now in drilling. If that kicks off, this could be a tremendous amount of boost to the economy in South Louisiana, because it's a lot of gas, a lot of money being spent drilling those wells, and there'll be a lot of production coming out of them.
So you see sort of a renaissance taking place.
We thought we were dead 20 years ago as far as drilling, because we had explored all of the basin. We had wells everywhere. We had the geology in all the wells, and the only thing we knew we had out there as landowners were some small gas sands, 6 to 8 to 10 feet, that the larger companies in the 50s walked away from because it wasn't competitive to economical to produce in them. Smaller companies started coming in and buying the old wells. Mm-hmm. You don't have any majors left out there. There, it's all.
Well, is 8 feet commercially viable?
Yes, it is. If you're small and if your lifting cost isn't as great as the larger companies. Mm-hmm. A small company can come in and take over a well if they can use the existing well, drill it out and complete it in another zone without having to run pipe and without having to do too much excessive drilling. Mm-hmm. Their lifting cost would probably be $20 to $30 a barrel. So they're making $80 a barrel. So if the well makes 20 barrels a day, they can make money.
Right.
Shell off lifting cost is $80 a barrel. So if they couldn't touch it in a million years. So the difference in lifting costs is the difference in why you got small companies in the basin that are buying up these old wells and going into these little zones and producing them that make money.
Mm-hmm. So how many wells have been drilled on your property?
I don't know.
Rough number. Under 1,000?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, under 1,000. If you really want to know that accurate information, you can talk to Weeks Gonzalez Law Firm in New Orleans. Don Gonzalez, do you know him?
No.
He's an environmental attorney. I hired him, I guess, when Kathleen Blanco was governor. The big oil companies were working on her to make the landowners liable for any pollution that would be remained today, because when Shell, for example, drilled a well, and they had a pit, and they had heavy metals, arsenic, everything in the world in it, it was okay. There were no laws conducting that activity. So in her mind, it was not their fault. And the landowners profited from the oil well, so therefore they should be liable for the oil well. So when I heard that she was talking about that, I hired Weeks Gonzalez Law Firm to go look at every location on Brownell property that had been drilled, every pipeline, every flow line, every wellhead, every structure, and make sure that it was properly abandoned. And if it wasn't, we went after the companies to get it done. Not one company voluntarily came back to do it. We had to sue each and every company, not for money, but to get them to go back and clean up the mess they left behind. And I'm at a stage now where I'm almost 100% complete. On every well that was ever drilled, it's been cleaned up properly. Every pit that was dirty has been dug out and refilled. Everything's been done according to DNR standards today.
So the pits themselves have been physically removed?
Yes, yes. Because mm-hmm. they're all full of arsenic, heavy metals, oil, of course. In the old days, if you had an oil spill, all you'd do is put soap on it, detergent, and sink it to the bottom, but it wouldn't get rid of it. So virtually around every platform we had out there, if you go do soil samples around that platform, you had oil and many other things. So I was concerned about that, so I did that. And now other landowners are doing it, and so is the state of Louisiana. They finally jumped in on the bandwagon. But they first told me, Kathleen had someone call me, I forgot who it was, and she's told me that, he told me that I was could possibly hurt the oil and gas industry in Louisiana. And I told him, I said, okay, I understand that could be. So I said, if you get the state to give me an indemnity against any liabilities that might occur from any pollution that might be on that land that I did not cause, I will stop. Well, we can't do that. I said, well, then I will continue inspecting my property and cleaning up my property so that I don't get caught down the road with millions of dollars worth of cleanup costs. It's been 5 years. It's been a long, long process, and it's worked. And it's actually cleaned up the basin. It's got all the pipelines, flow lines. And we've had some strange events happen. Just a couple months ago, I was in Colorado, and John called me. He said, we have a problem. I said, what is it, John? He said, well, these old flow lines in Bayou Pigeon that were put there by Shell, purchased by Taylor, later sold to L-Log, Apache, and all the other companies involved in it. We cut them to remove them, and they're hot. What do you mean? He said, well, they're flowing gas. I said, well, let them flow for a while. It's probably just pressure in the line. Well, a day later, they're still flowing gas. So I said, well, we got to find out where the gas is coming from. So we got people out there to follow the lines. But what happened? On our property, they were on the levee. And when they got off our property, it went on the ground. So we don't know where they were coming from, where they were going, but we do know someone was pumping gas through those lines that nobody was telling anybody about it. So those were hot lines that could have killed a bunch of people that we thought were all filled with water.
Right.
So if you find things, you'd be amazed what you find when you start digging out there. We had a place in up in by Pippard.
Right.
We had about 130 acres of land that was radioactive. I think Placid was the company back then. When we inspected that land, we had a radioactive situation out of this world, and we had it was like $130 million cleanup for them to clean it up, but we got it cleaned up. Mm-hmm. But that's I think. Most oil companies now are looking at that and say, hey, maybe we ought to make sure we clean up our land. Mm-hmm. And because you can't pass it on to the next guy that buys it. You know, the liability stays with the original owner for any pollution that may be on the property. So that's kind of been a new thing we've been doing. But all in all, oil and gas is in the basin right now is at a standstill. Gas is, you know, the prices are running with $320 to $360 or something like that. And $7 is a break-even point for drilling a new gas well. So until we see gas prices exceed $7, we're not going to see any activity in the basin, the shallow gas well, shallow gas drilling.
With the existing wells out there, I would assume that production has slowly tapered off over the years.
They're gone. Mm-hmm. Like the Brownell Land Company, we had one well that Davis drilled on the west bank of Lake Burette. It was producing small amount of oil and gas a day, and it was a secondary sand that was left behind by Union Texas Petroleum when they drilled the well in the 60s. And I just got a call from the other day that P&A in the well and they're pulling up the saltwater disposal well off my property. Mm-hmm. And the only other well that we have right now, just one well that's producing, is a basin exploration well. Knight Resources drilled it in the top of Lake Burette, and it was producing 150 barrels of oil a day and about 3 million cubic feet of gas a day. And then we had that sinkhole in Assumption Parish. Well, our gas sales line is Enterprise. They shut Enterprise down because it was too close to the sinkhole, so they shut us down. We had to shut the well in. We stayed shut in 4 months, 5 months, trying to get a permit to go back and produce the oil and flare the gas. And by the time we brought it back online, now we're making 200 barrels of water a day, 50 barrels of oil, and less than a million cubic feet of gas a day, which we're flaring. So that basically killed that well. The well's going to die. Right. And that's the only one we have. We have no more producing wells on Brownell land. And most other landowners are in a similar situation. There is nothing going on.
So if I heard you right, your land is in 5 parishes.
Yes.
And there's one well left.
One well left.
Well, In one way, would you consider yourself a pioneer in going back on your land and ensuring that it was clean to specifications today for future generations?
Yes, I would, because I was the first one to do it. First land company that actually jumped in with all feet and hired environmental lawyers who hired environmental experts to go out and soil test. Look for debris left by the oil companies, old heater treaters, any kind of piping, all the junk they leave behind, separators, wellheads, and made them remove them all. So everything is clean. But I caught heck. I mean, a lot of oil companies, a lot of landowners told me, I think you're making a mistake, and maybe, but I'm cleaning up the property, so that's not a mistake. You know,
right.
So it may be a mistake when it comes to oil and gas, and I didn't. It was coincidental, I think, that at the time I started this, oil and gas dropped off. At first, I thought it was nobody would talk to me because they saw me going around suing everybody, trying to get them to come clean up their mess. But after a couple years of it, I realized it wasn't me. It was a trend in the industry itself. There was no way to drill because the gas was too low.
Right.
So, but yeah, I was the first one.
Well, in view of the fact that there's only one producing well, and you said this is reflective of the general situation in the basin, what is the future for land ownership in the basin?
There is no future. The mitigation fees are so high that to use the land is impractical. It's probably valued at $450 an acre as far as the surface value. The only thing left is oil and gas and pipeline right-of-ways, and those are getting more and more difficult to achieve. Permitting is getting harder. Cod drilling is getting higher. And the real future, I think, is from, and this is from discussions with landowners and other oil companies in Houston, we're leaning more and more, although you don't see it, in the marketplace to natural gas. There are plants being built, there's more plants being built to handle natural gas. A lot of cars are looking at natural gas, and I think it will see a bubble in the, I mean, an increase in the use of natural gas. The fact that gas prices are so low and all that shale drilling has produced so much gas, it had an excess of natural gas that dropped the price down, that's going to go away someday because you can't keep producing it, and we still have a lot of gas in the basin. So when that bubble goes down, gas prices come up, the demand for natural gas in different sectors of our industry and our lives changes, we're going to have a natural gas run. And I think that's going to give a new life to the basin, but that might take 10 years.
Okay, well, do you think most landowners are willing to wait?
We have to. There's nothing else to do. Land ownership is a liability. It's not an asset. You have to worry about lawsuits. Everybody falls on it and breaks their leg. You know, there.
Right, but if they divest themselves of the surface rights and keep the subsurface rights.
Well, we've talked about that over 25 years. Very simply put, we don't trust the government. If you go back in history, you remember I used to work LSU, Glasgow, Dr. Glasgow. He went to be Secretary of Interior, I think, in what, 60s, 70s, 50s, I don't remember when. You remember the islands off of Alabama that they donated as game areas, wildlife management areas for the bird habitat and all that stuff.
No, I remember that.
Well, the landowners did that in contract with the government, retaining the right to drill for oil and gas and other products that might be beneficial to them, and they were given that right. And Dr. Glasgow took over. He reviewed that situation, and he wrote a letter, which I can't quote because I read it 40 years ago. Basically, what it said was the drilling for oil and gas on these properties is contrary to the purpose and the reason of setting up this as a natural wilderness area. Therefore, we're removing that right. Okay? Took it away. And that killed the United States of America as far as landowners donating surface. The surface of this land is worthless to me. You know, I think most landowners, if they knew they could donate that as a wilderness area and sit there and have it used by the general public but maintain the right to drill for oil and gas, they'd do it. But you can't depend on that. And so it won't happen. When was it? 60, 70, 80. Probably the 80s, late 80s, the state put on, the Corps of Engineers went on this big issue about buying surface value for $50 an acre, and giving all the landowners the right to drill for oil and gas. They tried like crazy to get that going, and they sent out books, I don't know if you've seen it, with piles of data, what they would, you know, what they would do. Yeah, I don't remember the detail, but you could harvest the timbers, but she had to leave like 40 basal feet per acre of cypress. She had to leave 100 feet between a waterfront and the beginning of the harvesting. All kind of rules like that, okay? And nobody trusted them. Nobody said, we give up our rights, what's going to happen? They're going to change it. They're going to take it away from us, and then we won't have oil and gas. So, in fact, that land is worthless except for oil and gas operations.
What about for recreation, like there are hunting clubs that have been formed. I know some associated with the Wilbert Land Company. Yeah. I've seen some with the White Lake Hunting Club and that sort of thing. Yeah. Is that a viable source of income?
No, but it's a viable source of protection for you. These hunt clubs are my right hand. They're looking at the property to make sure nobody falsely lives on it, builds houses on it.
So it's streets on the ground, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. They're my first line of defense against abuse of the land. And I don't look at them as an income source. It's not enough money to run the company. It is a very valuable asset to the landowner. Matter of fact, insurance companies like it when you have hunt clubs because they know somebody's out there looking at the land and they're insured.
And how many of those would you have on your property? A rough number.
Well, I've got to think a minute. Roughly 10.
Okay.
Virtually everything that we own is leased to hunt clubs, except for a certain parcel of land around Grassy Lake, which we keep for the family.
So that would be deer as well as duck?
Deer, no duck. There's no ducks in the basin.
Okay, so...
It's just deer.
Just deer. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Fur-bearing animals. They're going to rabbit, squirrel, deer.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And with black powder ending Sunday, I imagine there's some people out there right now.
Mm-hmm. I was out there last night.
Yeah. Now, let's go back when this industry began in the Brownell name in terms of oil and gas. You've actually given us a wonderful understanding of the technology that drove the drilling. But what about, you have to have employees, you have to have boats, you have to have watchmen. What part of that industry did Brownell play a role in? Or was it all industry folks?
It was industry folks. The only thing that landowners did when this first started, they either hired or contracted a geology firm to keep an eye on the well, to look at the units they wanted to drill, to make sure that you weren't being cut off or someone wasn't drilling a well next door to you and draining a unit on your well. We had to protect ourselves that way. But as far as all of the industry, oil and gas industry liabilities, was everything operational.
Now, these geological consultants were from New Orleans, I assume?
The one we had was from New Orleans, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he, I forgot his name. He's dead. It's been a long time. If I have any well drilled, I can look at the geology. Since I worked in the oil and gas industry, I can pretty much tell what the fault lines look like and what might be, might be. But only on a couple of occasions have I had to hire a law firm to go after a unitization problem. And in which case, I used that O'Bain firm in Lafayette. Mm-hmm. To argue about, and mostly what we argue about, like one well we had drilled, I think we drilled it, that was irrelevant anyways, over the basin, and I had the geology, let me back up, I guess about 15 years ago, a new word came into the industry called 3D, mm-hmm. We had linear seismic before that, and linear seismic is very difficult to interpret, you could give the same data to three different geologists, come up with three different answers. So they came through with linear. So when they did all of Brownell property, all of the land that I got have on that map that's blacked in, those are the different shoots that were done, and I have 100% of that data.
That's 3D data?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was my terms and conditions. You can do it, but I want 100% of all the data. I just don't want my land, I want everybody's. So they did that, and then I downloaded that, and working with a company in Houston, an oil company in Houston called Dimension Energy, and we downloaded all my data, and we looked at it, and whenever I had a well drilled, I would send them what the oil company would send me and let them evaluate the accuracy of their estimated thing. Sometimes they'd do it, and they'd come back and say, well, Mike, you got a 320-acre unit. You have a fault going down 40 or 50% on the south half of the unit. That is all goat pasture, and that's included in the unit, and that guy doesn't have any oil on the unit. So we go to court. Most time you lose. But we did go to court several times trying to say, hey, that's a goat pasture. You got to take this guy out of this unit. And some you win, most of them we lost. Mm-hmm. Because once they set the unit up in the state, they didn't want to change it. So. Mm-hmm. But that the 3D seismic gave us a new life for about 10 years. You know, we had new drilling going on. Until we found out it wasn't that accurate. You know, it was only really accurate when you had two or three wells that were drilled in an area where you could go to the state, get the downhole data and the production information on those wells, and then use that as an overlay with the 3D. And find, then they could come up with a better reading. But most of the wells that were drilled on our property used in 3D were dry holes. So it wasn't a big old, it was good in drilling, you know, for us, because we got lease options and mineral lease options and mineral leases but it wasn't that productive. It was a failure.
Now, how is your education background? Clearly you have an understanding of geology. Did you major in geology?
No. I graduated from Loyola University, and I went to work for Shell Oil Company. And back then, Shell put you through a training program before they gave you a job. So I spent time in drilling, I spent time in exploration, I spent time in geology, I spent time in administration, and worked all those fields. And then from working in the oil field, I worked always in the drilling operation. I chose that because that's what I like the best. And in doing that, you just learn by listening. Because you'd have the meetings, and the geologists would explain to us what they think, what they have, and we'd have to make a decision whether or not we believe them and go drill a well. And then we'd have to do the administrative portion, which I did, was the, how much it's going to cost. You know, what kind of materials are we going to need, where are we getting them from, when would they be available, would rigs be available, and we'd put an AFE together, and then we get it approved and drill a well. A general rule of thumb, from the time you identify a prospect, it's a minimum of 12 months before you can even drill it. Maybe sometimes 2 years, because you have to go out and look at the land. You have, first of all, procure land leases, identify ownership, verify ownership, and then from that point, you got to put all your economics together, do your AFEs, and you bring that to what we called at that time the, what kind of committee we used to have that ran the whole thing? I can't remember the name of it, but it was all the leaders of each department. And we'd all meet, then we'd talk about it. We'd look at the money in the budget for the following year, because you never did it that year because you didn't have the money in the budget. So we'd look at what we're going to do and how much budget, how much money we'd have, and then we'd pick the wells, we'd drill based on the money available, and then we'd put that into next year's budget, and we'd prepare the AFEs, and then we'd drill them in the following year.
As a general rule of thumb, how many wells could a company reasonably expect to come in as opposed to dry holes? What percentage during this time frame?
Well, exploration is 2 out of 10. Mm-hmm. Infield drilling is usually 10 out of 10. Depends, but we had some problems in the 80s where we had a lot of small companies. Davis Oil Company was one of them that I had to talk to for the lawyers for. They would go in and find something, and you had some big insurance companies looking to put money somewhere, so they'd give it to, like, Davis. Okay, here's $500 million. Put it in your drilling program. Well, what Davis would do with that money is he'd figure out, I think this unit is right here. I'm going to go right outside here and drill a well with their money and see what we got. And those wells would be dry holes. And then they go outside and drill, and those wells would be dry holes. Well, then next thing you know, it was Aetna, that one case I worked on. They were suing Davis because they said they wasted their money. And so when I had to go to court on this thing, and I told him, I said, basically, this is the information that Davis supplied Aetna, the geological report, the drilling, the mechanicals, all the way, everything. Aetna was not prudent in their operations by not getting another geologist to confirm the data. They just took the word of Davis and they drilled the well. So you can't blame Davis for them being ignorant of oil and gas. And they lost the case. So, you know, that's how it worked. So your percentages of drilling is kind of, if you really are serious and using your money, 10 out of 10 infield drilling wells will produce. If you're using other people's money, you might go to 6 out of 10 because you're playing with it. You're looking to see how far it goes, and it's easier to use their money than your money. So OPM, we used to call it.
What's AFE?
AFE is an authority for expenditure.
Okay. All right. Now, how long did you work for Shell?
15 years.
And then you became CEO here?
Mm-mm. No. When I was working for Shell, Allied Corporation, when I worked for Shell, I was over the offshore drilling operations. And Allied Corporation, a guy named Bill Geitz, who's the chairman of the board for Allied, approached me to go to work for Allied Corporation in Houston because they wanted to start an offshore drilling operation and an oil company. And it was called Union Texas Petroleum. So I talked to him, and you know, you don't leave Shell. You're born Shell. You go, you stay Shell. So I wasn't interested in leaving. And of course, when I came back to Shell, all my buddies said, "Union who?" it's a non-existent company. So when I looked into Union Texas, it had 14 gas plants, one olefins plant in Baton Rouge, which is Allied. And we had a couple little wells in Suffolk, Louisiana. And I thought about it as though I got crossways with Shell. Turn that thing off a second.
Wait one second. All right, let me check and make sure, please.
Turn that fan off too while we're taking the break.
Watch yourself.
I was hot at first.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3.
Business? Yeah, it looks like we are, but I'm having some gain issues here. Carly.
We may have to separate the mics a little bit.
No. Oh. That's not it. It's like...
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3.
It's just coming out of one...
One side. We're all right? Done.
Yes.
Thank you. We'll let it run till.
Yeah, we should be okay.
Watch your foot, Mike. A little dead air won't hurt.
No.
All right, let's. Okay. So you had a meeting with the Allies.
Yeah, and anyway, I went back and negotiated a contract with them, and left Shell and went to Houston, Texas.
You were in New Orleans at One Shell?
At One Shell Square. So that's my wife. We had just bought a house, and she was putting up the last curtains when I flew back from Morristown, New Jersey, and I said, going to Houston. She quit Shell. She came to Shell. She graduated from the University of Missouri, and Shell hired her when she was a junior to come work for them. And when she graduated, they sent her to New Orleans. That's how I met her. And we started dating. Well, you couldn't, at that time, you couldn't date anybody in the same company. So she had to quit. She went to work for Freeport-McMoRan. And then we moved to Houston, Texas. So that started Union Texas Petroleum career. I worked there for 15 years. And in that time, the company was in its infancy. It had a lot of room for growth, a lot of potential for adventure, if you will. So we started off with our first well in the Gulf of Mexico at Eugene Island 385. Still got the little rig on the desk there. See that little one over there?
Oh yeah.
That's the first drop of oil in the platform that we put out there to drill the well. And so we started there, and we started drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. We expanded our onshore operations to the Permian Basin, to Oklahoma. We bought Instar in Lafayette to give us a base right there. And we bought Supro and Energy in the San Juan Basin in Farmington, New Mexico. So we were spreading out our onshore and our offshore wings. And then we decided to go international. So we started drilling in Indonesia first. And then we moved to Pakistan in the Badin field, and we started drilling there. And so we had Badin, we had Pakistan. We bought 20% ownership in the Piper Claymore platform that operating out in the North Sea. And we had a worldwide operation after about 10 years. And then, I guess, Bill quit. Bill retired. Bill Geix, he was a really good gentleman. And we hired a guy called Ed Hennessy to be chairman of the board of Ally Chemical. He had no knowledge whatsoever about oil and gas. And he kept calling me up there, you know, where's the money, you know. Oil and gas companies value their worth by barrel of oil equivalents, not by money in the bank. And he couldn't get it through his head. So after about 5 years of making mess with him, he finally decided he wanted to sell Union Texas to buy Signal. So he gave us 3 months. By the time we got off the plane in New Jersey and got to Houston, the management committee, that's what I'm trying to think of, I called Joycelyn, my secretary. I said, have the management committee stay because we've got to have a meeting. It was about 7 o'clock at night. I get in from Morristown. I go up to my office, and Joycelyn says, Mr. Hennessy, I want you to call him before you go in your meeting. Okay. So I called him. He said, what's up? He says, don't worry about what I told you. He said, I just made a deal with KKR for 50% leverage buyout of the company for $500 million. I said, oh, man, you know, that was the beginning of the end. And over the next 3 years or so, we fought that. First of all, we sold off our onshore properties, then we sold off hydrocarbon operation plants. Then we sold off our offshore to LL&E, and it was so overrated, it was unreal. You remember Leighton Stewart? Used to be, see, I was on the landowners board of directors for the Landowners Association, and Leighton was on that too. And I told him, don't buy. And, you know, I was, and don't buy. Anyway, he bought it, and they went under. He made a really bad decision. And they kept the international stuff. So that was at the point where the only option I had if I wanted to stay with them was to go international, and I did not want to live in Pakistan or Indonesia. So I retired. I took my package, and basically, and I retired. And it was just coincidental at that time. We decided to move back to Morgan City because Renee and I had a child that had CP. And it was a very difficult living in a huge city. So we thought we'd move back here and be around family. And I basically retired, and I started a consulting company called Vanover & Associates, and I did different things like testifying in court. I was expert witnesses on different issues and stuff like that. And 2 years later, Doc Brownell, my father, we were boiling crawfish one day, and he went to check on his camp. He had a dog out there that they had to feed every day. So I got a phone call. They found his boat turning circles in the river, you know, so we knew something happened. So we found his body. He died. So then I knew nothing about land ownership, nothing. And Doc didn't know anything about land ownership either. He had no records. I mean, it was just poorly run company. You know, it only ran because it was making money. And he had a secretary. So Ann asked me if I would consider doing this. And I said, well, I'm retired. Find something to do, you know. So I came in here and I had to learn the land business. I knew the oil and gas side of it, so I had a hand up because at least I could talk the business, and they couldn't fool me with what was going on. I knew what we were paying for leases. I knew what the royalty were. I knew everything about it. So I had a little hand up on everybody when they come to talk to me because I could talk their language. I knew what they were doing. But if you talk to me about timber management or I don't know anything about that. And so over the period of time, I finally found out. I didn't even know what the contract we had. I had to wait till I'd get a check from somebody. And I called them. I said, hey, look, guys, I said, you know, Doc Brown recently passed away, and I'm trying to update our files, and I can't seem to locate our original agreement. Could you send me a copy of it? And they sent me a copy of it. I started making files of what we had and what money was coming in and why it was coming in and what was going on. So it took about 2 years to fully develop all the activities that the company really had going. And finally I did it, and then, of course, things started dying off then. So
right.
It's been a merry-go-round for land management. But even today, I do this part. This is part-time. As you might imagine, there's nothing going on. But somebody's got to do it, and I can't seem to find anybody else in the Brownell family wanting to live in Morgan City to do it. So,
well, we talked about the economic changes that have taken place, and the challenges that has posed to someone in your position. What about you talked earlier about the environmental changes that are going. Have those impacted your responsibilities as
no
manager?
No, it's only hurt the nature of the. Mm-hmm. The basin, it basically took away the deep bayous, the natural beauty, and of course, every time you mess with nature, you mess with something else, you know. And
right.
What we found happened was over the years, you'd have your floods, you'd have your delta buildup, they call it. You had the lakes filling in, and you also had all your bayous would fill in with sand on the edge of the banks. Okay, so after so many years of filling in, they would. We had river channels. We wouldn't have water flowing through the swamps like we used to, because these levees that were naturally built up on the rivers was killing the swamps. So we had a lot of dying trees. We had the crawfish industry was suffering real bad, and we had to really work hard to get the Corps to cut some cuts in there and do some things that would flood the land back to try to restore it to somewhat of a natural. But we did lose all of our lakes. And I remember the original plan the Corps came to. My dad was mayor at the time. Oh, he'd been there for like 35 years, but he showed me the plans. They had it drawn down all the way from Quad Springs down, a 400-foot wide channel, 40-foot deep, all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. Okay, they got up north of Grand Lake up here, and they ran out of money, so they had to stop. By the time they wanted to get started again, the environmental groups had formed. And these environmental groups wanted environmental impact studies. So they stopped them from continuing drilling. So what happened was that water would come boiling down and stop dead. And when it was stopped dead in Lake Grand Lake in those areas, all the silt would fall out. It wasn't moving. And that was filling in the lake. The grass filled in the river. The river was about, sometimes you could see sandbars in the river now. It was 100 feet deep at one time. And so it, you know, whether it's good or bad, I think it depends who you talk to. We're better protected from hurricanes because of the delta buildup on the coast. We lost beautiful lakes and destroyed most of our rivers and our bayous, and now there are sandbars and all that stuff. But the country itself seems to be adapting to it. The land is. I mean, it's the animals and the crawfish is coming back. And the only difference is for the problem to a landowner it causes is simply a trespass problem, because where we used to own the land along the edge of the lake, now you got maybe 200 foot of sandbar in front of it, so that's state property. So people have a right to go on that property. When they go on that property and wind up running dogs on your property, and of course that's only hunting and stuff, you know. But so it made it harder for us to control and to mark and mark our lines of ownership and all that stuff. So
let me get this right. If a lake fills in and that lake is abut your property, even though it's become land, you don't own it, the state owns it.
It's water bottom. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's how the state acquired so much land in the basin.
Now, there are reality shows related to swamp people. Mm-hmm. Do you have alligator leases?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Crawfish also?
No, I don't. But if you tell this to people, I'm going to probably have everybody be on my land, but we don't make money crawfishing than people do. So I don't patrol the land nor stop them from crawfishing on anybody on our property. Mm-hmm. I buy insurance. Hope they don't sue me. So I don't do that. But I do the alligator tags, and it's not really an income thing there. You don't make any money on that. But Troy Landry, the great alligator hunter, has one of my. I started him on Brownell land. Landowners were scared to let him do it. Wilbert, for example, wouldn't let him. And I said, I can't see any harm in it because they're not on your land. They're in the bayou. They're in natural waterways. So they can't really sue you if somebody gets bit because they're in the bayou, you know. So I thought I'd take a chance with Troy and let him go do it. And now they're doing that new one with Ricky Phillips. And CMT called me. They wanted a landowner involved in some of this filming, but I think people don't like landowners. They got to realize we're the bad guys, you know, because we don't let anybody on the land. They can't hunt on the land. I said, they don't like me. I said, you don't want me on the TV show. But they have Ricky, and I think Ricky's got an engineering degree from LSU. He's not a fool. He just chose to live the life he lives. And I think they have Cliff LaGrange in that thing, or they're going to get him. Cliff's a mechanical engineer, retired. So they finally get some people that can talk. And people with knowledge rather than those toothless wonders. But it's not their fault. Like the blonde-haired guy with no teeth, the kid, when he made a little money, he wanted to get his teeth fixed, and they wouldn't let him. The History Channel didn't want him to get his teeth fixed. They wanted him to look like that. But people were poaching alligators before. And this is just simply another method of controlling who's on your land. By giving people the right to do it legally, they in turn protect your land from trespass.
Yeah, and you mentioned like if an oil company comes in to drill, they have to lease land and use the term bonus, and there were some other terms you used. Can you explain those terms to people, what they mean?
Yep.
I mean, it would be very helpful.
Okay, well, generally, what will happen, an oil company representative will contact you one way or another, usually now by email, and make you an offer for a certain acreage of land, send you a map with what they want on your land drawn out, and that original offer will contain what they call a bonus, which is the upfront money they pay for the rental. And then you have rental, which is equal to the same amount of acreage as the bonus, and then you have royalty. And then the primary term of contract usually is 3 years. So let's just say $250 is a going rate for a mineral lease. So they'll offer you $250 per acre bonus. That's before they drill. And then that's good for 1 year. And if they don't drill in 1 year, they have to pay rental, which is the same amount of money as the bonus. And then once they do drill on the land and they produce oil and gas, a 25% royalty is a pretty standard number. So the landowner will then receive 25% of any of the products removed from that well. And if they don't do anything in 3 years, the primary term of the lease, they may have it at the landowner's option, be able to come in and negotiate another 1 or 2 year extension of the lease, but there's no obligation on the landowner to extend that lease. And sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. If we think they're just trying to hold it to put together deals and get people to buy in, but I have a guy over here telling me I'm ready to drill right now, well, he gets it, but I have to wait 3 years. But that's it. The primary terms, of course, you get your legal terms, your indemnity terms, and the product information terms. And the simple terms of the lease is simply bonus, rental, royalty, and primary term.
And there have been a couple of pretty significant Louisiana lawsuits where landowners have gone back and reassessed the oil company's production and found out that their 25% wasn't correct. Does the oil company provide you the information? We produce X number of natural gas, X number of oil this month, and you have a right to go and check that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can check the meter runs to see how much gas is flown, and you can check the sales slip to see how much oil was shipped. That's an option, though. That's not often done, because oil companies rarely would do that, because that would void their lease. And then all of a sudden, you don't 100% of the royalty that comes out of that well. But you get reports. Let me see if I got one this morning. Like I said, the only well I have going, which is a bad one. And this is what you do in every well. If you have 50 wells producing every morning, you want to get the production report. And you want to get it day by day, then monthly, and then you keep them. And you look at it. You look at your royalty, you compare it to what they're getting.
Well, let's go back a minute. When you took over, your father apparently didn't have a lot of the contracts.
And he didn't know anything.
So you were really starting at ground zero,
mm-hmm.
and had to build up the knowledge to even know where to go get these records.
That's
Is
right.
that correct?
That's right. Yeah, I didn't know. I couldn't find mineral leases. I couldn't find contracts. Because it was a simple method of waiting until it happened, get a check, call them up, and play stupid. And then you were worse stupid because you didn't have files. So you update your files, and then I'd tell them, well, I'd like to. You can request that as the landowner, even if it's not in the lease. You can request that they give you a daily drilling report, activity report. And these reports, you can have it for your file. It gives you the data report like yesterday, okay?
Okay.
Downtime, zero. Tree choke time was up 13. 8, heater choke. We had 3,002 fluid pressure, 3,000 pounds. We flared 700,000 cubic feet of gas. Low pressure flare was 43 barrels of oil were produced. 256 barrels of water. See what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
How this well just went to the dogs.
Wow. And
so if you want to, if you have any problem at all, you can. That's their sales line. That's the numbers that they sold. So you go back and you can figure out what the cost of gas is, and you can figure out the cost of oil, and you can figure out 25% of that. And then take your percentage of the royalty of the ownership. You might be, say, a 50% owner. And you can come real close to the number. And if that number's way off, you might want to look at it.
So all of this is posted on the Internet?
No, just for me. That's private.
Okay.
Yeah. They send that to me because I'm the landowner on the well.
Okay.
It's not posted.
Okay, so they send it to you by email, I take it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, go ahead, Carl.
No, go ahead. I have some other questions, but I wanted to lead us in another direction.
Well, that's where I'm headed. So, you know, an old family name in Morgan City is Kyle, specifically Ed Kyle.
Right.
Were the Brownells and the Kyles ever involved in any joint businesses?
Only in Wells, all Wells.
Okay.
Yeah. Ed Kyle was me. He ran the Kyle Lumber Company, and he ran the Kyle Peterman Land Company. Newman Trowbridge was involved in that. He was the attorney for them. And the guy that runs it now, his name is John Hine. He's a geologist in Houston. He runs a company called Tutuga Operations, or GIN. They're going to Cayman Islands. So John and I are counterparts, and we talk constantly, as I do with Rudy Sparks, who's a counterpart, because all of our lands are near one another.
Okay, now Rudy Sparks is with the Williams.
With the Williams.
But in Patterson.
Right. But he also manages Norman and Brough property on a contract basis.
Okay.
So we need to take Brownell, Kyle Peterman, take Williams property, Norman and Brough property, Generate Lumber and Shingle property. You got most of the property. Wilbert, you got, that's pretty much it. So we don't talk, we don't violate any rules of conduct as far as how much are you asking for, how much are you getting. We never discuss that. But we do discuss activity. We do discuss, hey, John Doe, our company just called and they're interested in this section, certain area of land, you know. So I'll go look at my map and see if I'm anywhere near it. If I do, I'll do a little prior research before the phone call to see where we at. I look at the geology. I kind of get an idea what they may be looking at and where I might be in that unit. And that gives me a negotiating edge on what I get for the lease. You know, if you look at your geology and they're drilling right here and you're over here, and there might be a 10% chance that you might even be in that unit, you have less negotiating capabilities of getting more money than you do if you're over here.
Right.
So it just gives me an edge, an oil and gas edge. I know what you're looking at, I know where I'm at, and this is what I want. Mm-hmm. You know, and when they know you know, they do what you tell you. You tell them, they don't argue with you, you know. But we do talk and we do share knowledge. We talk, we get emails on a daily basis from each other. We'll forward articles that we might see about McMoran drilling or about some other some field being found here or this new type of drilling program. Then we trade that data, industry data.
So, now, how do you define a unit?
A unit used to be, well, you want to go back to this thought?
Yes, please.
In the old days, they'd drill a well. And they'd go out and they'd say, well, we can't take a chance. We're just going to draw a circle. And we're going to buy everybody in that circle. And then when they drill the well, they would drill the well, they'd flow the well, they'd test the well to see what they had, what kind of flow and tubing pressure they had, how much volume they had. And they'd go down and they'd do a dip meter survey. The dip meter survey would give them an idea of where the unit goes, how big it is, and what it is. So then they draw it. It might be like this, you know, or it might be like this. Or it
could
might
be a circle. Yeah, it could be anything.
So they would go then in that area, well defined, okay, and they would go to only those landowners and do royalty payments. They would drop the mineral lease with the rest of the people outside of the unit. They would not pay the rental. You already paid the 1 year rental, but they wouldn't pay the second year rental. At that time, it was put upon the landowner to go get his own geology to see if he agreed. Well, the last 15 years or so, they simplified it by making drilling units. They go in front with DNR, they get usually a 320-acre drilling unit, and they drill a well. And they don't care, and they don't try to go see where that goes, to tell the guy outside that unit that you might be in it, but we're draining you, you know. And it's up to you to look at it. So you have to get better at looking at geology. You have to look at the units. You have to know more than you did a long time ago, because it has to be known up front. And if you want to challenge them, it's very expensive. If you see where they're drilling a well and you're not included in the unit, and you think you are, and you have geology to back it up, it would behoove you to get a geologist and go meet with the company and say, look, I understand you're getting ready to drill. I know you did a mineral leases here, but our records indicate that this unit extends further than you think it does, or than you want to admit it does, that we'd like you to include us in the unit. If you get them up front, you usually can get them. But if you wait till they drill it and the units form, it's very difficult.
So by you having these 3D seismic records, mm-hmm. that is your unit archive.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. You see all the green arrows on that map up there?
Yes.
Those are prospects that I've identified through the 3D that we have.
Okay.
And those are things that I think will sell in the future. As soon as gas prices go up, I'll be able to go to the oil companies. We go to the oil and gas expos, and we'll actually put together a prospect list and give it to them. Say, hey guys, you know, my jump on them is I have the data. Okay, I can't sell that data, but I can use that data for Brown Hill Kid use only, according to our contract. So I can say, hey guys, I'll tell you what, this is what we see. I've identified it. We are looking at it on the geology. Here's a cross base of the geology. If you're interested in looking at that, you can go to Dimension Energy in Houston, and you can look at that data. You get your geologist to go over that data, and all you got to pay for is the geologist with Dimension watching over your shoulder so you don't copy the data. It won't cost you any money up front. That cuts $500,000 to $1 million out of the upfront cost of buying the data to look at it to begin with. So that's what these green arrows are. These are things that I have in my back pocket that I'm going to try to sell when gas prices get up to oil companies to come drill these units. I can show them where they're at. I can show them the map. I can show them the geology, and they can make their decision. If they decide they like it, they'll buy a mineral lease and drill a well.
Yeah, now, the Brownell name is associated with the Brownells and Drews Lumber Company.
Right.
Brownell and Kidd.
Right.
I think it's K-I-D-D, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any other marriages with companies that were involved in primarily logging?
It started off the Berwick Lumber Company.
Bourbon?
Berwick.
Berwick, okay.
And it was owned by the Brownells, and it burned down. I don't know when. I'd have to go back way back in the files. But when the Berwick Lumber Company burned down, Brownell family formed a partnership with the Drews family. And it became the Brownell Drews Lumber Company.
Both in Morgan City?
Yeah, both. It was the one in the waterfront here. That's the map. That's the picture. That's the Brownell Drews Lumber Company. I would think it would be in the 50s. Roland Kidd came along, and I don't know why they got in business with Roland Kidd. It was a terrible thing for the company, but Roland Kidd came into the company, and then it became the Brownell Kidd Company. After Roland Kidd was kicked, gone, died, out of the way, and it was the Brownell Kidd Company still, that's when the LLCs came out, so we decided to form an LLC instead of a partnership, and we made it the Brownell Land Company LLC.
Now, when was the Berwick Lumber Company formed, approximately?
Approximately 1895.
So it would be fair for Carl and I to say this company is 100 years old.
Yes. Yes, oh yes, by all means.
Well, keeping with that theme about the lumber company, mm-hmm. you mentioned earlier, Mike, about some of the enormous stumps, cypress mm-hmm. stumps that you've seen out in the basin. Can you describe some of those?
Well, they're huge. They still exist. Cypress is very resistant to rot. But when you have high water, you can get in the swamps. Off and back in different areas, you'll see these trees. They're just guessing, probably at least 10 foot in diameter, and they're all, you know, they're rotted out, eaten out. But you can still see the base of the tree where it was.
Right.
And there was a lot of trees like that back then. The tales from the old people, before they cut the trees down, said that the cypress tree forests in the basin were huge trees with huge coverage, with very little undergrowth because of the coverage. And the ground was walkable, and it was covered with cypress needles. It was just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And they cut them all down.
Right.
Yeah.
I've seen one lithograph of a man standing in a wedge in one of these old-growth cypress mm-hmm. trees. And it looks like a sequoia. I mean, the thing's enormous, but this grown man actually fit inside this wedge, and
they're huge.
we'll take a little break and look at some.
Okay,
if I all right. still have that stuff here. I think I might have given it to the Cypress Sawmill Museum.
I just asked Mike to talk a little bit about the family's ice plant.
Oh, yes. People Ice Company.
Yeah, the People's Ice Company. Well, I can tell you when I was a kid, I drug around 200-pound blocks of ice.
Wow.
And we had an ice company. It was located right there on Brownell property, right where the mill used to be on the waterfront. And you'd have shrimp boats that would come in and park underneath the chute. And you drag the big 200-pound blocks of ice and you throw them into the grinder. Then it would grind it up and put it into the shrimp boats. And when the oil and gas industry took off, the shrimp industry slowed down. And eventually it became a non-profit company, so Doc shut it down. We've had a couple other people try to do it in the past, but it's not economically feasible. Right now, City of Morgan City, has a grant to put a ice plant by the railroad bridge. They're working on feasibility studies of driving piling and putting it on land or putting it on a barge. But it's actually a state grant that's going to pay for it, and it's going to be run by a private enterprise, but they're not going to have to pay for all of the equipment so they can make money. But it's done to try to bring shrimpers back here, bring the industry back into Morgan City.
Well, when did the plant shut down? Do you remember?
I'd say by probably 1960, 62, something like that.
Now, one of the things we're always interested in is photography. And I honestly, Michael, can't remember, but I have some photography that was given to me with the Brownell and Drews pull boat, or at least one of their boats.
Mm-hmm.
It may have come from Catherine Dilsaver many years ago. So, when we look at your memory of this Cypress industry, did the company own, let's call it a labor barge, that is a houseboat? They take into the basin, people work there, and then they come out on the weekends. Do you ever recall the company owning anything like that?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a sleeping quarters building. There wasn't any in those pictures I showed you there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just a camp. Oh,
wait, no, I'm sorry. There is one in here.
Let's grab them.
Oh, yes.
There's several in there, Doug.
Hey, Luke. Hello. Good morning. Yeah, but I'm in a meeting. Yeah. I'll call you when I'm free. I'll go by your office, okay? Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
This is magnificent. Well, these are the kinds of things Carlin like and I would enjoy scanning, I think.
Well, you take them, yeah.
And then we would, of course, return them. But now, when you look at an image like this, there's always individuals who are working. Do you know if all those people came from Morgan City? Or a lot of them came from Michigan, Minnesota?
Yeah, we have anecdotal data and very occasional reference in the newspapers. After the Civil War, when the big logging companies first began to move in the area, they moved in from the upper Midwest, and apparently they took a lot of their people with them.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about, from what your experience from the 1895 on, by that time, were they hiring local people? Or are they?
You know, that I don't know. I know the Brownell family were all carpetbaggers, and they came down here from the north. And I would think that any industry would have attracted people from anywhere there's no work. I mean, maybe not out of state, but certainly from around the surrounding areas. But I don't know. I have no employment records at all.
Okay.
Well, earlier you mentioned a chain dog. Could you define that for us, please?
Yeah. A chain dog, it was a piece of equipment. It had a possibly an 8-inch long blade, about a half inch thick, inch wide, like a hatchet blade almost. It was connected to a chain with another one on the other end. And they'd drive it into the log, one log, they'd drive the other one into another log, and they'd do all of that, and they'd grab onto all of those logs. They'd had the industry itself, start off in the basin, go to Flat Lake. The process that they did, it was like almost like they'd dredge a canal, called a pullboat canal, okay? Then they'd dredge runs like fingers off that canal, going all to different areas, which are smaller canals, but called pullboat runs. Pullboat runs, I guess, is the proper way to say it. They call it pullboat runs. And then they cut the trees down. They'd drag them out down that canal. They'd hook them up. They'd cut off the junk limbs on it, and they put chain dogs on them. They'd have pollens out in like Flat Lake. And in one case, I can tell you, as a fact, Williams and Bronio owned a set of pollens out there, but because we got sued because somebody hit them about 40 to 30 years ago, and they traced it back to us. But they take the logs out and they tie them to those pollens. Then the paddle boat, you see, would go out there, hook onto that whole batch of logs and tow them into the Morgan City to the mill. And then they pick them up and they process them in the mill. So it was just basically, you start off, you dredge your canals, and you put those dredges back there that you saw.
Right.
And you'd pull the logs out and you put them in a pile, you cut the debris off of them, trim them into stumps, logs, and then pull them out, hang them in the lake, bring them to the mill. It was a simple process, and that's how it was done everywhere.
Now, what was the primary products produced by the mill?
Lumber, as you saw in those reports. You had different grades of lumber. All the Grobeck cypress you see now that people cherish, that was actually used for packing boxes and stuff like that. Then you had the heart lumber, which was used for construction of boats and anything that was fine carpentry wood. And then, of course, you made shingles out the rest of the junk.
Right.
That shingles were a byproduct.
What about railroad ties?
I don't know. I don't know if they made them out of cypress or oak trees.
Okay.
Where was most of this marketed?
All over the country.
Okay. It wasn't strictly a local market.
No. It was shipped everywhere. It was the steamboats would come to town. They'd load those steamboats, the schooners, I guess you call them. They'd load them up and they'd take them all over the country. So.
Now, do you think that the manager of the Williams Lumber Company should be somebody that Carl and I chat with?
I think Rudy Sparks would be very valuable to talk to. He knows more than I do.
All right.
I can't touch his knowledge on the land industry, lumber industry. Okay. He majored. That's his major, his education major, and he does a really good job.
All right.
Well, thanks for the recommendation.
That would be very good.
Yeah. Yeah. Rudy can enlighten you a hell of a lot more than I can.
Okay. Well, no, you've been very helpful. You trust it. You've been very helpful. So, as a landowner, and as a person who has an environmental interest in the basin, clearly, it's in your blood. The basin is truly in your blood. And you're not finding any family members who's willing to take over the responsibility?
No. It's simply because they don't want to live in Morgan City. We don't have. All of it, just to go through Doc Brownell's direct descendants, Ann Bailey, Brownell Bailey. Ann lives in New Orleans. She spends most of her time in Shelbyville, Tennessee. She's the major landowner, percentage-wise. We split up. The Charleston family was the other side of the Brownell clan. Those kids live in Annapolis, like the one that I was looking at, Carrie Charleston. A couple of them live in New York. One of Ann's kids lives in New York. One of the girls lives in Shelbyville. Patrick, who is the only male descendant in the Brownell side of Ann, direct descendant from Dr. Brownell, he lives in Atlanta, and he has no desire to move back to Morgan City. So it's just it's kids branching out. They go into different career fields, and Morgan City is not. It was attractive to me because I grew up here, and I wanted to get away from big city. I worked all my career in big cities. I wanted to slow down. I wanted to see and live a little bit. So I came back to Morgan City, and that's the way it is. In most cases, kids go. They take off, and this thing doesn't make enough money to really support a person that would be trying to support a family. You know, it's
full time.
Yeah, it's just not enough money there. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you to look down the road 10 years. Mm-hmm. Based on your long experience here, what do you see?
I see a rejuvenation of drilling for natural gas. I see the country is going to change whether they want to or not. They're going to depend on natural gas because it's green, it's readily available, and we have a 200-year surplus. And I think you see a lot of plants going natural gas, a lot of new industry being built. As we speak, there are things being built that will be using natural gas as a driver. And I think that's going to be our future. I think hydrocarbons, oil itself, will become less attractive and will be primarily used still for gasoline, but for the byproducts of plastic and all the other components that go with it. And the plastic industry is big on oil and gas. Did you know that Shell Oil Company, Dan, I can't remember his name, he was a chemist for Shell Oil Company in Houston. He accidentally created a plastic bottle as a byproduct of what they were working on. And I remember talking to him. He says, you know, would you believe that Coca-Cola, all the soft drink companies want us to make these plastic bottles, but they want us to make them with a 13-week shelf life, so that the carbonated gas out the Coke will leach through the plastic in 13 weeks and become flat. He said it's a strategy, a marketing strategy. They don't want that bottle to stay good for a year. They want it to, if you don't use it in 3 months, you ever have a little flat on you? It's designed that way. They make that plastic so that will happen. It's amazing, isn't it?
You know, you and I've talked before we recorded. Mm-hmm. Would you comment a bit about your involvement in a fundraising event where sportsmen clean out their refrigerators and you have kind of a banquet? I know you were involved in that, maybe established it.
Yeah.
We'd like to get that on tape, please.
Well, this was something we've been doing from the Shrine Club, the St. Mary Shrine Club, a part of the Acacia Temple in Baton Rouge. We support hospitals. We support handicapped children, orthopedic and neurological damaged children for free. Regardless of whether you have money or you don't have money, we don't care. And I got involved with them because I have a child that has CP. So I spent many years at that hospital. And we were trying to think of fundraisers and talking about planning, and we're brainstorming at a meeting about fundraisers. And I thought about my freezer. It's always full of game, and the heat hunting season starts, and here we go. I got a whole freezer full of last year's rabbits and ducks and deer. And I came up with the idea. I said, why don't we do a fundraiser on the Thursday night before Friday, when the hunting season opens up for squirrel and rabbit and deer, and have people, encourage them to empty their freezers and find people to cook the food, and have a wild game dinner. And so we did, and we started off in the Bayou Vista Community Center. The first year we sold out 350 tickets.
And what year was that?
15 years ago. We had our 15th annual one last September. We started off, I think we had alligator sauce piquant, turtle soup, and venison chili. And that's the only three dishes we had. And then it caught on. People, the Cajun people who love to cook, of course, they started coming to us and say, hey, I'll cook. So the second year we had it, we overloaded the place and they kicked us out because they couldn't have, we had people parked half a mile away. So we went to the Morgan City Auditorium, and the fire marshal told us that we're limited to 1,400 tickets. That's all we could sell. So we raised our cooks, we had 24 cooks, plus desserts of all kinds that people would bring in, and coffee. And we wouldn't sell the tickets per se. People would give money, donate $25 to the hospital.
and we would give them a ticket to come to our wild game dinner. We called it our wild game appreciation dinner for the supporters of the hospital. And it turned out where we sell 1,400 tickets every year to the same people who bought them for 15 years. We don't have any extra tickets to sell. People call, but we don't. We put them in envelopes. You bought 10 last year, you can get 10 again. And that's how it works out. But it's 24 different wild game dishes. Since it's kind of sensitive, you can't sell wild game. So we don't sell it. It's just really appreciation. And to cover ourselves, we have the district attorney cooking, the wildlife and fisheries cooking, the sheriff department cooking. So we kind of covered our back on that. And we've had some people, History Channel recorded at one time, and we just make it very clear that we're not selling wild game. People are donating money to the hospital, and we appreciate that. So we do this as one big appreciation dinner. And it's been a remarkable fundraiser, and it goes, all the money goes to the hospital. Virtually everything that's done is donated, everything except the rental of the auditorium. The beer is donated, the cooks are donated, the food is donated, and the cooks. I think maybe 2 or 3 out of 24 surround us. The rest of them are community people in the community that just like to do it. And it's been a great fun thing. It's women, it's children, and men. We started off thinking doing only men, but we thought that might get rowdy. So we thought if we let them bring their children and wife, they might be a little more nice. So we started that way, and it's worked great. It's been a great fundraiser. It's fun to do, and it's good.
Well, growing up in Morgan City, you know, tell us what brought you back. I can understand living in a big city, mm-hmm. but there must be a childhood memory or two that has stuck with you.
Yeah, well, I grew up in the swamp, basically. My grandfather was a fisherman and a trapper, and I spent a lot of time with him in all the rivers and bayous around here. Doc Brownell was an avid sportsman. He loved to fish and hunt, and I grew up doing that. That was kind of what you lived for. Even in high school and sports, I only played football because it usually ends around Thanksgiving, and that was the hunting season starts. So I wouldn't play any other sports because I don't want to interfere with my ability to go hunting and fishing. And I just enjoy the outdoor life. And when I went to college, of course, I got out of college, I had to go to the real world, and it was work. Had very little time, very little vacation. And
I would think in a place like Houston, very little opportunity.
Yeah. And every time I'd fly from New Orleans to Houston, I'd look down at my camp on Grassy Lake, because that flight went right over that lake, and I'd look at, man, I wish I could retire. But most of it was just a love for outside. I love outdoors. I love nature. I love going out there. I love being out there. And like I've told many of my friends that come to my camp, that fishing out here, it is a blessing. Catching fish is a bonus. You know, we don't need to catch anything to be out there and have fun. But and I was just in love with the area, and I always said I wanted to retire early. One of my jobs, when I was, like I tell you, we went through training with Shell. Well, I spent 6 months of that training in Human Resource Department, and I'm just young, 21-year-old kid out of college, you know. And I'm looking, and we'd hire somebody, and we put $3,000 into a fund called the Providence Fund that would cover that guy's retirement at age 65. And I sit there, I look, and I think, how in the heck can you make enough money with $3,000 to pay the man which his projected retirement would be for the projected wage he'd be making after all those years till he died? So in a meeting one time, I asked some of the leaders in the public, in the Human Resource Department, I said, tell me about that, explain that to me. And at that time, this is in the early 70s. And at that time, he said, well, son, he said, what you got to realize is that most men work till they're 65 years old and die at 68 years old. So this is enough money to put them through 3 years of retirement. They live longer than that, we're dipping into the kitty. I'm saying, okay, so that kind of rung in as being sad but true. So as I worked up in the management positions, I started giving performance evaluations to 50-year-old, 55-year-old men, and they weren't bad evaluations. They weren't very good. And all they would tell me is, I hate this job. 15 more years and I'm out of here. I'm a going pecan. And I remember thinking, you dumb, you stupid. You can work the best years of your life at a job you hate, and you can retire and die in 3 years. How stupid can you be?
So I vowed to myself that I would retire early. So I basically retired at 45 years old, full retirement except for part-time stuff like this. So I dedicated my work career to working, saving money, and retirement early, and that's how I did it. But that's when I wanted to come back here. And Doc hadn't died then. He was still alive when I moved back to Morgan City. He died 2 years after I moved back here. But I just wanted to get out of the corporate world. I wanted to slow down. And I had friends of mine in equal jobs dying at 40 years old of heart attacks. And I was always on a plane, always going around the world, never home, and it just a long time. So this was an area I'm familiar with, I love, and I came back here.
So. Well, Carl and I have been looking at recreation. That's why we were asking questions about deer hunters. And we've run across some firearms we want to know if you've heard of. This is shotguns. Parker?
Yeah. Oh, it's a double-barrel shotgun. Quit making about 80 years ago, probably.
Purdy?
Nope.
H&H?
Yes.
Holland and Holland. Mm-hmm. Right. Holland and Holland. Do you know anybody that owns a Holland and Holland?
No.
But you know of it?
Yes.
All right. A Purdy is like a Holland and Holland, except we have a photograph of a Purdy for sale at their manufacturing site in London for $400,000. We feel pretty confident there's at least three of them in Louisiana.
Yeah.
That becomes important when we start looking at the value of hunting to some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I mean, its economic impact is huge in Louisiana, as you know.
Yeah, you know, but it's
very, the economy has very largely turned a blind eye to it.
Yeah.
But as Don said, it shows the value that people have, their personal priorities.
Sure, the hunting.
For hunting.
Pissy. I have a Parker.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's a very prestigious American firearm.
Mm-hmm.
Damascus turn barrel or not Damascus?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. It's my grandfather's.
Wow.
But I have that at home. I looked at it the other day. I cleaned it up. I have it.
Well, that's a tremendous heirloom.
Guns. Yeah, yeah. I got it from my grandpa. I got the Parker. And you remember the movie with Jimmy Stewart, I think? He was in jail, and he made the first automatic weapon, the rifle with the barrel that would slide inside the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
I have that gun. That weapon is the 35 Remington automatic. But the barrel actually, there's a solid barrel, and the inner barrel actually goes back as the whole breech and shoves the bullet
out. Now, is that here in Morgan City or at your camp or in Colorado?
The rifle, the both of them here. I got the Parker rifle in my son's bedroom, and I have the shotgun in my closet, my gun, all of my other guns, and I have the other rifle on the wall.
Well, then, we know you're going back to Colorado. When you come back, would it be all right if Carl and I come and take one photograph of each firearm? Now, we don't have to acknowledge it's in your collection, because that can be sent.
Yeah.
But it's important for some things that we're working on to show that this is a firearm that has a lot of value to true hunters.
Yeah.
But the Parker especially, because it was a firearm that was highly, highly valued in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
Well, serious hunters.
Serious, yeah. Here. I've got both of them. You can take anytime you want. You can go do it today if you want.
Well, we've got another little thing we have to do, and we'd like to do that. My grandfather, my dad's dad, had a Parker. I did not inherit the Parker. The Parker's disappeared in the family. I inherited a double barrel, but not a Parker. And yet, in the time period that Carl's talking about, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, it's a very important part of Americana. And if we just get a photograph, that's all we want.
Yeah,
but that's the kind of record that we're trying to capture.
Yeah, yeah, we can get those pictures. I have another weapon, but unfortunately it's in Colorado. It's a lot of old guns. A lot of old rifles and stuff. But I have a Browning shotgun. It's gold engraved, gold trigger, two barrels, straight stock, English stock.
Wow.
And the serial number, I've sent a picture to Browning. It was made before they started collecting their weapons to put in their museums. It's a beautiful,
really?
Beautiful shotgun. They'd love to get their hands on that.
Oh, I bet. I have a Browning automatic Belgian made. That was my father's. And that has, from my family, my mother only worked once in her entire life. She worked 2 weeks. Made enough money to buy that shotgun for my daddy. I have that gun.
Yeah.
Now, Now, the double barrel I've given it to a friend who will take very good care of it. I'm not a gun person, but that is important. And the other thing that Carl and I, you've documented very well, that you played football until Thanksgiving because you wanted to go out and take advantage. Well, we've interviewed people that have quit a job because they wouldn't give them off. And that's very hard. That's very hard for us to go to regions outside of Louisiana. Explain, they don't get it.
Yeah. Well, it's just where we were raised. You know, the camps was a way of life, and being out in the swamp was a way of living for us. And you fall in love with it. You know, it's just something you can't get anywhere in the world. I've been all over the world, and there's nothing like this place anywhere else in the world.
Well, I have one final question for you, Mike. Could you verbalize, tell us what the importance of a camp is? Because as you said, for people who are not, who haven't grown up with it, who aren't involved with it, it's another world. They don't understand it at all.
Solitude. Simple as that. You go out to a camp, you have minimum creature comforts, which is adequate, and it's beautiful nature. You just sit there and listen to the birds, look at the fish, look at the gators, and It's what you call meditation for some people. It is for me. I mean, I love to go just because there's nobody out there. Just because it's private and I don't have anybody around me. And fortunately, we own the land, so the camp's on Grassy Lake. And Bronnie owns most of the land around Grassy Lake, and I won't let anybody else put anything out there. So I don't have noises, I don't have people, I don't have radios blasting. You go out there and it's quite nice. I had to live there after Katrina. My wife and I, we were living in Berwick, and we sold our house the day before Katrina was named a hurricane. My mom got married to a guy in New Orleans, and she was living in New Orleans. So that's old Brownell house here. So I said, Mom, can I live in your house while I'm building a new house? She said, sure. Well, Katrina blows Charlie's house underwater. Here they come, living here. I said, what the heck am I going to do? Well, I got a houseboat. I made a traditional houseboat, like the old boats they used to live in. It's a duplicate. I've even used sinker cypress. But all the lumber inside made every board that's inside that boat. Beautiful boat. So it's I had the camp on Grassy Lake. So the hurricane blew down the wires, and the camps are the last thing that they put back up. So I parked my boat in Stevensville behind one of my lots, and we lived on that boat for 3 months. Renee, Russell, and I, and the two dogs. And it was okay, and we she laughed sometimes. She said, "We know we're lucky. We at least we have a roof over our head." I said, "Yeah, we are. We had a great time." So then we got Pablo back at the camp, and basically what we did, we left the boat in town, and we booked the camp for only a 10-minute boat ride. So we'd go to the camp during the week, and Renee would hang out. She paints. Her hobby is painting, and so she'd stay out there and do her artwork. And I'd come to town, come here for a few hours, do whatever little coffee clutch I had, go back to the camp, and do whatever. And it was funny, one night we were sitting on the gazebo. Every evening we went on the gazebo and we had a martini. So I'm sitting on the gazebo and I could hear this chopper coming. Boy, chop, 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 chop. The real loud noise, and it wasn't a Bell helicopter. I said, I've never heard that helicopter before. And I'm listening and we didn't know what was going on. And all of a sudden, here comes a Blackhawk right over the camp, low altitude, maybe 100 feet. Whoom! And he comes across, what in the world? And then an airboat comes flying out of Persimmon Pass. And a helicopter heads towards that airboat and starts shooting at it. I mean, it looked real. Explosions and all kind of stuff. Did World War III break out or what? You know? I didn't know what the heck was going on. Well, that was that movie, Deja Vu. I didn't know they were making the damn movie right there. I said, Jesus Christ, did World War III break out?
Now, does the Brownell own the land of Stevensville?
Some.
Okay.
Some.
All right. Because there was a cypress logging mill at Stevensville at one time.
Don't know.
I was told I could get you close to the site if we were there. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I don't know. I never saw it, and it must have existed. I don't know if it existed in my lifetime.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Well, I've exhausted my list of questions.
I've exhausted mine.
Mike, thank you. This was wonderful.
Absolutely. We really appreciate it.